You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
So I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Given the venue, I think it's going to be a very healthy dialogue and a chance for discussion. So we'll spend a few minutes up front framing the broad issues in front of my, at the top of my mind, and then I'd like to engage with you all on questions and dialogue so that we can make this a productive half an hour session. First of all, let me thank Congressman Goodlatte, and I guess in the morning, Congressman Goodlatte was with us as dear friends and strong leaders on this issue. I'm particularly thankful to Congressman Zoe Loughran, who will be addressing and has addressed me earlier today, but is hosting us, obviously, at her alma mater. She has been a terrific voice on these issues, and you couldn't pick three better members of the House of Representatives to help us spearhead this discussion. So I'm going to begin my remarks with sort of the 100,000-foot view. The 100,000-foot view in technology is as follows. In our personal lives, we are consuming technology in ways our public policy framework has yet to match. As I look at the rate at which we are adopting technologies, we have more cell phones adopted in America than we do dishwashers. We have bandwidth consumption rates that are exploding. You and I as Americans consume a little under 1 gigabit of data every month. Projections are that that will grow fivefold by the year 2013. And that's just on the application base that we know. Companies are innovating at dramatic levels. Game-changing products and services are coming to market. Just this morning, I had the pleasure of visiting with a number of innovators in the smart grid space in the energy sector. And I thought I'd share one story on game-changing innovation and use that to springboard into the priorities that we have. In the old days, if you wanted to have a home networking system, maybe for big-time folks like Congressman Goodlatte and others, they could afford these $100,000-plus systems that would be manufactured and available for folks to get their homes wired for the 21st century. But as we look to democratize access to information about your energy consumption in the home and so forth through the work of the smart grid, it's obviously one key element is making sure that you can have access to that networking infrastructure. I don't think you and I can necessarily afford the $100,000-plus technology cost to systems integrate the home networking capability. Here in Silicon Valley, a venture-backed company, Control 4 Systems, decided to fundamentally re-engineer the way people think of home networking and build products and services that start in the hundreds of dollars, not hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is not a 10% discount on an approach that had historically been done, not a 20% discount. This represents 90 to 95% reductions and sort of game-changing innovation, and we see that in our private sector. So we are celebrating a lot of the work that's been done in our personal lives. My neighbor has one of these systems. He keeps telling me, he's going to talk about this in your remarks. It's so cool. But the point is, when you look at the indicators of progress on innovation, unfortunately, we have not yet caught pace in our public policy. So I want to share with you one report that Rob Atkinson wrote from the IT and Innovation Foundation. It was published in February, and it's the report that keeps myself up at night in terms of policy. He looked at 40 countries across 25 indicators of progress for global competitiveness. Across these 40 countries, he benchmarked and said that the United States is in fairly healthy positions on a variety of these areas. So the headline reads, America remains competitive, we're doing well on broadband, we're doing well on areas. However, he then cut the data somewhat differently. He said, let me look at the rate of change. What progress are we making on some of these key indicators? And as he cut the data that way, a startling finding emerged. And that is, from the period 1999 to the year 2009, if you index all the countries that were being benchmarked across these 25 indicators, and you measured everybody equally in 99, and you measured them again in 2009, in terms of the rate of progress across this index, the United States ranked 40th out of 40 in performance. Now, you would expect the leader, because one's already near the top of their game, to effectively slow their rate of growth, because you know you can only go so far So on the surface of it, you don't get too alarmed by the fact that we're 40. But when you drill into the data, you get a little bit concerned. And the two pieces of information that keep me up at night that reflect the priorities that I wish to bring to the administration are, one, on electronic government, we have been a world leader. We always consider ourselves to be fairly successful. But in the measurement criteria for e-government, as measured by the United Nations performance, the United States actually declined 7% on the benchmark. In fact, we were dead last across the countries in terms of the rate of change. Countries, while we still rank in the top three in terms of our overall position, because everybody else is still behind us catching up, the countries behind us were growing 10, 15%. So if you project it out in the years forward, we were not going to be in a very healthy position. And then similarly, the president has said, for global competitiveness, there's almost no single greater indicator of performance than higher education attainment. That is the rate of our adult population that has a college degree, 2 or 4 years. The United States essentially has been flat in our higher education attainment rate. This has been a big priority of Congress elect for us in Virginia. We've had the bipartisan Council on Virginia's Future really make this their cornerstone initiative, but I'm assuming this is happening in state capitals all across the country, which is how do we get more folks through the pipeline and to get the kind of credentials necessary to be globally competitive. We were dead last. We're near dead last in terms of the rate of growth. Again, if you look at the countries, we used to be number one in the world on the rate of our adult education population that are at college levels. We are now falling quickly into the out of the top 10. And because of our rate of change, we've got a lot of room for improvement. So with those big themes, we have a robust agenda on how we should turn this ship around. Our agenda in Washington is threefold, and I'll spend the bulk of my remarks going deep on one of those areas. First, we think there is absolute importance to invest in the building blocks of innovation. We see the building blocks of innovation in three parts. First and foremost, we see them in the area of smart, secure infrastructure. So where the federal government does its job well, on roads, highways, broadband, air transportation systems, how do we ensure that when we make investments in that infrastructure, that we're doing so in a manner that delivers the kind of smart and secure capabilities that over the next 20, 30, 40 years will deliver value and return to the American people? Second, we see an opportunity to promote research and development. The United States government spends $150 billion a year on research and development. We may debate whether the number should be $160 billion or $140 million. But a lot of my interest is on the balancing of the portfolio. Are we ensuring the right return on taxpayer investment? Are we holding ourselves to rigorous standards? Are we making sure that we're balancing some portion of that to make sure that we're commercializing the research and development to promote private sector innovation? These are questions that are on top of my mind, and we'll focus a lot of that investment into building blocks. The third dimension is the one that I've referenced in terms of the workforce, and that is making sure that we have a base of individuals who can be very global and competitive. I think, Congressman, you're going to engage on some of those issues in the conversation that will follow. But I cannot tell you, I'd say with 99% confidence, if I sit down with a CEO, when I ask them what their top of mind concerns are, they might first give me something that's sort of their government affairs person told them to say was number one. And then their number two immediately following is workforce, because that's at the heart of their issue, which is the difficulty of recruiting the right talent to be successful. In addition to the building blocks of innovation, the final two pillars of my priority is to say, look, while we have to get these macro conditions right, we also have some very specific priorities that our country is grappling with today. No bigger issue on the president's agenda than health care reform. And there's no way on earth we achieve what we expect to achieve in healthcare reform, which is moving to a system that rewards wellness and prevention and keeping us healthy. We cannot transition the system to that model unless we see fundamental investment in healthcare information technology. So engaging in how technology can promote our healthcare system, obviously a major priority for the administration, as well as the energy grid, how we can leverage technology to lower our energy consumption patterns. It's amazing to me, just by optimizing information alone, we've seen case studies of individuals lowering their personal energy use 20, 30% just by knowing that you shouldn't do your laundry at 4 p.m., do it at 6 p.m. and you should avoid being closed. That kind of transparency of data has been remarkably powerful. We want to really hit that point home in our strategy. And then third, and certainly but not least, was the notion of the role of technology in education. Here we are interested in a very interesting debate in the Congress, Congressman Whitlocker, where under Congressman George Miller's committee, we're looking at the future of learning. No matter how you look at it, if we are to achieve our higher education attainment goals, we're going to have to find a way to harness online learning capabilities and other emerging technologies to get more and more of our Americans engaged, if not through the immediate K-12 and the systems beyond, but also in the spirit of lifetime learning. And so we see a great opportunity for improvement through our community college network to promote distance learning and technical training, because we see that as one of the most underleveraged assets in America today. It certainly was, Congressman Gillette in Virginia, a key part of the story over the last 50 years, why the Virginia economy moved from being back of the pack to front of the pack. I would argue in a bipartisan way, we probably reached consensus very quickly that the community college system has had a pretty big role in helping us shift from back of the pack to front of the pack. I think that story is being told all over the country. But last but not least, in the part that I'll spend the last few minutes on before we wrap, we must in Washington learn to eat our own dog food. And what I mean by that is, it is one thing for us to come to Silicon Valley here in the state of the Midwest and share these remarks with those of you who are at the cornerstone of innovation. And it's another to say that we'll be adopting those innovations in how we run our government itself. There is absolutely no reason on earth that we shouldn't have the most innovative and effective government in the world. And the president has laid out some key principles that will help us deliver that kind of effective government. It's in the president's open government agenda. On his first Monday in office, President Obama said, "I'd like my chief technology officer," hadn't been named yet, "to report out on strategies that will make government more transparent, more participatory, and more collaborative." And these principles will be embodied in an Office of Management Budget Directive that will go out to all the agencies. But bigger than that directive, we have been embodying these principles. I'll share with you a few stories, and then I'll wrap with some final remarks. I'll share with you the story of the development of open government policies themselves. To my friends our congressional friends in the room today, normal Washington policymaking effectively is as follows. Congress will pass provisions that will require implementation. There will be notices in the Federal Register for public hearings. There would be sort of a perception that we're hearing from you, and then we would turn ourselves inward. We'd go silent, essentially, and then from on high, we would emerge with draft recommendations for whatever the provision is that we're looking at, and the American people would be quite simply wondering, where was my input, and how did it relate to these outputs? And there was this concern that the policymaking process itself wasn't really geared to maximize public participation. We thought to experiment. Why not experiment in drafting recommendations on open government using open government philosophies? So we didn't have a set of tools that we could deploy ready and available. So we sort of stitched together three free tools to give you a sense for how we wanted to engage the American people. The first thing we said was, my first day I was sworn in on May 22nd. That very day, we launched a brainstorming effort where, for about a week's time, over 1,000 comments from the American people were posted on blank sheets of paper. What would you like us to do to demonstrate open government? Not only did we accept 1,000 ideas, but the tools that we used allowed for voting. So 33,000 Americans then voted on those 1,000 ideas so that you could see what was bubbling up and what didn't fall. Now, we did have some of those birther type things that showed up on the website. We also had some of those UFO type things about where we were. Yeah, and the Congressman reminded me, and legalizing marijuana. We certainly had a lot of that appeared in the public domain, as you would expect if you had a channel where anyone could represent their voice. But if you mine the data, and all of this is transparent, you can visit it online right now. If you mine the data, you would find that there was actually some pretty healthy information. We mined it using MindMap software and other tools, again, that were free and available. We We then identified 16 categories where policies would be relevant. We then took experts from across the federal government who wrote blogs describing the issue around those 16 policy dimensions and invited public comment, where again, you could post a comment and vote. And again, we received nearly 1,000 comments. When we graduated from the first phase to the second phase, we saw a dramatic reduction in the UFOs and the marijuanas and the earther issues. But we saw a lot more of a really healthy debate. That informed the third phase, where we used a wiki-like technology and actually said to the American people, folks, why don't you put pen to paper digitally and actually write the recommendations themselves as a community? And again, nearly 375 entries were submitted where people were editing each other's work. And unlike Wikipedia, you could vote up or down on any particular change to the document. So right now, if you visit our website, whitehouse.gov/open, you can see the results of all three of these phases. And it's been a remarkable journey for us to experiment with the spirit of open government as principles. And you can see this in our results. We're now taking that information and using what I call outside-in policymaking, using the voice of the American people to inform how we set about our directive and our policies, and that will emerge as we go through our policymaking process later this fall. And my hope is that you'll see some fairly thoughtful alignment between what the American people had asked for in this sort of crowdsourced way and what we were able to deliver. I'll end with this final comment, and that is this. When we think about these big issues, whether they be on healthcare, IT, or the energy grid, or building blocks of innovation, or the open government framework, we must think of this in two parts. One, how do we engage our policymakers to ensure that we're doing the right things by way of public policy long term? But then two, given the policy environment in which we are in right now, what in 90 days can we do that makes the world look a little bit better? If we keep to that discipline of balancing results in 90 days, measured progress, demonstration against the long-term goals, coupled with a commitment to getting the right policies in place, I think we'll have a platform to deliver the kind of results we expect for the American people and the African American people. With that, I will say thank you for your time, and I welcome a chance for some questions and comments, and Tim has got the mic for your chance to weigh in.
In the interest of protocol, I will ask the first questions and comments.
Yes, the protocol indeed. Good call, Tim. Thank you for that. Congresswoman.
I actually haven't gone to the open section of the White House, but did you analyze where the input was coming as the American people, but was, a lot of people in America are busy in Ohio going to work. Was it people who were hired as lobbyists? Was it people in the Valley who've been laid off and have had lots of time? Were you able to do an analysis of where this input was coming from?
It shifted. The question was, how did you determine what the source of it was? Our first phase largely was driven by campaigns by those who care about open government, where email listservs had been already in place, individuals had been focused on this, thinking about these issues for a long while. Congressman, I don't know if you'd call them lobbyists in the capital L sense of the word, but they would be organized groups that would share comment. As we got closer to the drafting and so forth, we started to see individuals participating and contributing. And I think this is a mixed bag when you look at this writ large. One of the initiatives I had done when I was in Virginia, to give you a sense of this, the power of this, our education department in Virginia identified that children in sixth grade fail the pre-algebra test more often than almost any other exam. And when you identify the root cause of the problem, it was they couldn't figure out proportionality and fractionality. So in traditional procurement, you would issue some kind of an RFP and say, which big business or organized group would have a solution for me that would address this issue? We tried this open government approach, and not, I'll tell you the exact opposite of it. What we said is we have no money, although we scrounged up $5,000. We're going to give a prize to the iPhone app developer who develops a cool game that demonstrates progress against the stated objective, which is, can you help the kid understand fractions and proportions? And in that example, Congresswoman, just an average Joe heard about the challenge, wrote up a game, you know, over the course of a couple of weeks. It's called Number Line. It's free. You can download it if you happen to have one of these devices. It's addictive, by the way. I actually play it. It's a lot of fun. It reminds me about it. It asks you to score from lowest to highest on the proportionality. So these open government endeavors ideally are engineered so that the power of the American people can be heard in ways you wouldn't expect, although it doesn't happen in any uniform way as we experiment in this regard. Congressman Goodlatte, do you want to? Yes, sir.
I'm Ronnie O'Brien, in the Lake of Rose, Texas. I just had a pop-off because I do have noticed that, you know, you stay in pre-office for forever because it won't be popular, and the failure is really at fractions of decimals, somewhere between the third and fifth.
You agree with that?
Totally agree, but your ninth little app on the iPhone.
Yeah.
Now we've got billions going into education, and it would never pass all the boards in the bureaucracy. It's approved, you get to the test. Weren't for an open internet. But, you know, it's wonderful. But how can they fail so magically with so many people reviewing it? And I have five sons, and we had the year through to get out from the eighth grade. And we have to be considered giving them, telling them the PSA says they can't do it. But the Russians can teach their kids in the third grade algebra.
Yes, sir.
You know, but right there, fractions and decimals. And I'd love to see everybody have the app, and we can do away with three
algebra. Critical to the question. Was we did not run the competition as a sidecar Charlie, if you will. It was run by the superintendent of the Department of Education. So it came pre-baked with the kind of blessing from the regulatory process that gives comfort to the schools that they could adopt this technology and therefore do this. We had done a similar initiative where we commissioned, through open collaboration, a set of physics chapters that were not. If you look at the economy of Virginia, for example, modeling and simulation happens to be an industry that we think has high growth potential for the state. Yet, not a single one of our high schools were teaching modeling and simulation lab work, and it wasn't part of any physics curriculum. Because the superintendent of education partnered with us to bring about the role of technology in education, we actually commissioned high school teachers to write the modeling and simulation lab book and made them available through a wiki-like format, all for free, virginia.ck12.org. Anybody in the country can download it. There's 10 chapters of content. Didn't cost the state a nickel, nor a dime, nor a penny. And the educational system embraced those principles of open collaboration, Congressman, to your question. Average Joes, great high school teachers from the Shenandoah Valley, Congressman Goodlatte, contributed in Harrisonburg, wrote chapters on biomedical imaging, believe it or not. And so these high school teachers were given the chance to write content. It was peer-reviewed, quality-reviewed. We had university faculty make sure that it wasn't didn't pass highly qualified information. But because it was done in partnership with the regulatory apparatus, it gives confidence that it can scale up. In fact, days after we announced that this thing had happened, a dozen school districts across Virginia announced that they would incorporate at least one or two of those chapters into their coursework that fall. In fact, Albemarle County in Virginia adopted a netbook strategy where for every physics student, they decided to forego the payment of a $150 physics textbook, use the flexbook instead, which was free, and they used the savings from that to subsidize the netbook purchase, which made it more cost-effective for the school. Every physics student in Albemarle County, Virginia, because of this initiative, will have a netbook with all this physics content available to them. If you marry up the policy-making apparatus with the principles of openness, yes, sir, in the back.
Richard Denner, I didn't mention before I worked for the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation.
Hey, my man. Did I quote it right or wrong?
Excellent.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you for bringing that up and also point out we've got a more recent report out about innovation and policy proposing the creation of a White House Office of Innovation Policy. And people can check that out at our website, ibif.org. And regarding fractions, you know, did volunteer work in my kids' elementary school, is that baseball is an incredibly good way to teach kids to trick them into learning statistics. It works better for the boys than for the girls, obviously. But I got a bunch of kids.
I disagree with that premise. Right, Congressman?
The
team is
baseball.
Oh, I see.
Good, you're a kid. Yeah. Because of our backward ways and the patriarchy.
I make no comment on any of this.
Yes, good thing not to. But yeah, I got these kids. I taught a bunch of sixth graders how to write computer programs in language called Logo. And a bunch of the boys wrote a baseball program. And it turns out, you know, initially they wanted to do all the sort of eye-hand coordination stuff. But then when they started looking behind the scenes and collecting statistics on actual players, and they had to figure out how to compute a batting average,
yeah,
and an OPS and some of the advanced statistics that drive baseball fans crazy, that they ended up accidentally, in spite of themselves, learning an awful lot about fractions and decimals.
Let me comment on that story. There is actually a policy question embedded in that story, and it is as follows. If you actually, I mean, there's going to be a lot of debate in the Congress about measurement, and if you look at how we measure education today, folks, like on the ground, go to the Department of Education in any state in America, and you wanted to correlate performance on any of these issues, the only thing you can really test today is proxies for teacher quality on student performance. So what happens is there are these tests that are run through the No Child Left Behind Act. You can find out from the data if the children were higher proportion of reduced in school free lunch program kids, so you can proxy for poverty. You can correlate the teacher in the classroom and then through other databases identify how long they've been tenured. And you can track where they were, what school district, and so forth. But the question that you pose is really a question of curriculum and content. So teacher A, with the same profile as teacher B, introduces a logo-generating game-based approach to addressing some topic, and teacher B just relies on the traditional textbook. Our data systems today do not allow us to analyze the marginal value of this new content in helping to explain the particular content that you're trying to master. I am very keen in the work we're doing in education technology to raise the question, how might we build more robust systems where we can better track the kind of curriculum learning objects that are in place that could be innovative and ensure that those can be reviewed and analyzed for performance. So what I hear too often from teachers is the whole system is built on relationships, and oh, I heard so-and-so did this thing, and can I have an email copy of that lesson plan? You can go to online repositories where this stuff is stored. But it's all one big wild, wild west of content and curriculum sharing in the classroom. And we really have to find a way to bring analytics rigor. If the Redskins lose on a Sunday, Congressman Goodlatte, and I am about to hang out with my buddies on a Monday afternoon to sulk in the loss, Best Buy knows exactly what promotion to run to convince me to buy a plasma TV. Because they have all that data in their transactional systems, and they analyze this thing ad nauseum. Imagine if we had that on your logo program or any one of a number of things to say what content or collection of content delivers the most value across a set of students to ensure that they can be competitive in the 21st century. That is where we need to go. We are nowhere near that. Yes, sir. Tim, I'm calling on you to make sure I don't go over the limit. I cannot take away from Congressman last time.
Thank you. My name is Daniel Yost. I'm an attorney at ORAC here in Silicon Valley. My question is, are any of the open government tools that you've been talking about being used in support of the president's clean tech agenda, you know, the green economy agenda, using these tools to develop ideas?
Yes, 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 and yes. First of all, let me say this. Part of my job is to instill a culture of open government on behalf of the president. So what we are trying to do is to stand up what I'm referring to as the government labs or cloud computing, you know, turnkey, or we're going to come up with some branding and some name around this. But basically, sometime in the not too distant future, my presumption is in the fall, we will stand up a place where these tools that are largely free but have to be verified for security purposes and other things, that we will provision them in a manner that will be as easy as, look, the vision should be, if you and I can consume this stuff in our personal lives as easy as a click of a button to get going, then the federal employees that wish to use them in the running of their business should be able to adopt them with simple, similar ease. The most obvious example on Clean Grid is on Monday, I addressed the standards body organized by the National Institute for Standards and Technologies, NIST is the agency responsible for organizing a roadmap for energy grid standards. And we are using wiki technology to get the community to help us quickly identify standards. But I want to go even further. I basically want to do the following. I want to see competitions in every community in America where these devices are starting to be in place, that is the smart meter devices in a home, married up with all of the consumer electronics innovation. And I want to see about this sort of very public competition that will say, how do we measure which set of products and services are most effective at changing my behavior? As I said earlier, to change my laundry habits from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. I don't know if one game-changing product is available for us to consume today. But if we let 1,000 garages flourish where they experiment, and they're all probably in the Congresswoman's district, a lot of them are here, my presumption is that those entrepreneurs who can consume the energy data from the meter in an open standard could be in a very strong position to innovate on ways in which they can convince me to change my behavior, absent financial incentives like pricing and some of the bigger issues that these good people here have to grapple with on how we manage energy as a matter of public policy. In my little corner of the world, I want to be helpful to move the ball forward on bringing innovation and entrepreneurship. They can set the macro agenda on how we do some. So the wiki is but one example, and there'll be more. With that, I'll say thank you for the chance to share with you my thoughts.